I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Later in the show, we will learn more about E.J. Antoni, Donald Trump's nominee to lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He's chief economist at the Heritage Foundation, the far-right think tank behind Project 2025. But first, we're discussing Russia's ongoing war on Ukraine. Last Friday, Donald Trump greeted Vladimir Putin on a red carpet with smiles and handshakes in Alaska. Putin unleashed a devastating war on Ukraine on February 24, 2022. The UN has recorded at least 13,500 Ukrainian civilian deaths, including 716 children. Over 34,000 Ukrainians have been injured. Close to 400,000 Ukrainian troops have also been killed or wounded since the invasion began. And on the Russian side, the number is just staggering. More than 1 million troops have been killed or injured, according to the British Ministry of Defense. Just a week after Trump met with Putin, Ukrainian officials said Russia launched one of the heaviest bombardments in weeks, 574 drones and 40 missiles. Al Jazeera reports that last summer, the Russian army appeared to adopt a new tactic. They started flying dozens of drones in southern Ukraine to follow cars and people in a video game-like chase. They've dropped explosives on civilian targets, wreaking havoc. People say they're afraid to leave their homes because so many are now being killed by drones. Terrified people refer to the drone attacks as a human safari. A May report from the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Ukraine found that Russia is committing war crimes. In March 2023, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Vladimir Putin for unlawfully deporting and transferring children from occupied areas of Ukraine to the Russian Federation. And then on Monday, Trump met with Volodymyr Zelensky and European leaders at the White House. The last time Zelensky met with Trump and J.D. Vance, they berated him for not thanking Trump for, quote, trying to bring an end to this conflict. This time, J.D. Vance told Fox that he warned Zelensky to, quote, behave. The New York Times' Karun Demirjian writes that it was not the first time Vance addressed Zelensky with words more commonly spoken to a toddler than a head of state. Joining us to discuss media coverage and the latest in Ukraine is Jen Stout, an award-winning journalist, radio producer, photojournalist, and author of Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war. Jen Stout's work in Ukraine has been shortlisted for prizes by Amnesty International, the Foreign Press Association, and the Scottish Press Awards. Hi, Jen. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi, my pleasure.
Great to have you back. Jen, before we talk about the politics here, as you know, there's so much happening in the United States. And for people who have not been following the latest in Ukraine and don't really know what's going on, can you give us an update? You linked to a piece by Oleksandr Mikhed, who just wrote on August 14th in The Guardian, "The enormity of the attacks on Ukraine is impossible to grasp. Let me show you the horror of a single day. The rumble, the explosion, and the deaths, they are so frequent, they seem normal. It's a fight to protect our homes, our cities, and the psyche." So can you give us an update on what has been happening?
Yeah, absolutely. It is hard to overestimate, hard to really describe the horror of what's happening every single day in Ukraine. I think because it's been happening for 3.5 years now, mm-hmm. it almost doesn't make the news in the way that it should. And that's pretty grim if you're Ukrainian in particular, if like me, you're kind of half there and half in the UK and constantly watching the news in Ukraine and thinking, gosh, well, they've just hit a massive apartment block in Kharkiv and I don't see it in the headlines because it's almost a daily occurrence. It's an appalling situation. You mentioned what happens in Kherson. I mean, that's been going on for a while, but Kherson was liberated in November 22. It's down in the southeast of Ukraine. And we were celebrating so much, I remember. You know, it was an incredible time in Ukraine. There was a great sense of hope and optimism back then because they'd managed to take back so much land in that incredible counteroffensive, you know, September, October 22. We never imagined how Kherson would be punished. And it is, I mean, the Russians are practicing. They're practicing their drone hunting tactics, as you say, the safari, human safari, on the people of Kherson every single day. This has been going on for quite a while, and it's It's utterly horrific, utterly horrific.
Danielle Bell, the head of the UN Human Rights Monitoring Mission in Ukraine, said, in many areas, daily life is dominated by the need to take cover. People often spend hours taking shelter during large-scale strikes, only to emerge and find their homes or businesses damaged or destroyed. This repeated cycle of sheltering and loss is becoming a harsh routine for many communities. Children spend many nights not tucked in bed, but sheltering in corridors, basements, and bathrooms, covering their ears from the sounds of sirens and explosions. I mean, it really is incredible, I think, because of our election. It's just so easy to forget that Putin unleashed this devastating war on February 24th, 2022. So Ukrainians have been dealing with this for years. How much longer can this go on?
Well, look, they won't give up because they can't, you know, because it's existential. They very well understand, and I wish that people in the West would also understand this thoroughly, that the Russian war of aggression there is ideological. And you've heard this from Putin and Lavrov in the last few days. This is why there can be no peace deal or negotiations at this point. Russia wants Ukraine not to exist. And I don't understand how anyone has any doubts about that. So of course Ukrainians have to keep going. It would be great if we could help them a bit more, wouldn't it? And it would be great if we could have actually properly helped them over the last few years. Strange to see Trump now saying that. I mean, you never really know what he's going to say from day to day, do you? But right. But now he seems to be saying, well, Joe Biden only gave them just enough to defend themselves, not enough to really win. And I think that's true, not just Biden, but European countries as well. I think we collectively bear a lot of responsibility for the horrors that Ukrainians have had to endure and keep enduring now.
Can you tell us more about this? Why doesn't Russia want Ukraine to exist?
Well, there's a very strange... I lived in Russia for a little bit before the full-scale invasion. I was on a fellowship there. So I kind of... And I studied it all my life. I kind of had a bit of an understanding and an insight into the sort of madness that country has descended into. And I really think it's a kind of psychosis. But it's a very twisted version of history in which they're always the victims, which is what, you know, empires who've done very bad things often cast themselves as victims, because otherwise it's quite uncomfortable, isn't it? And so Ukraine, in their version of history, which you can find in an extraordinary and completely insane essay that Putin wrote shortly before the full-scale invasion, or you know, a historian wrote with him, where he outlines the way that they think about Ukraine, which is that it's not a real country. It's basically Russia. It's small Russia, and that it should be back into the fold of the Russian Empire, which, you know, when the Soviet Union, that was a version of the Russian Empire. Things were controlled by Moscow. Many other countries were subjugated and oppressed, just as it was in the Tsarist Empire. And I think this is what the current Russian Federation wants to return to, is that sense of greatness and a real obsession with World War II. I mean, I think, you know, everybody wants to feel proud of something, don't they? And in Russia, I think that is becoming hard. And so they really hammer into people just on and on and on about the great victory, their great victory over the Nazis in World War II. But without really understanding, I didn't meet a lot of people who understood what Nazism was, what fascism actually is. And the great terrible irony there being that they can't see that they have themselves become it. Because for them, you know, all the way through Russian history, they would refer to anyone who opposed them as a Nazi. That, you know, after World War II, so people, partisans in Belarus, for instance, partisans in Ukraine. And it's a very complicated history. But that rhetoric that you hear about, and it doesn't make any sense, right? Because Zelensky is of course Jewish. Ukraine is not run by neo-Nazis. That's ludicrous. But it does make sense in that sort of mad, twisted Russian version of reality that they seem to have sunk into. And they just cannot... is seemingly cannot accept a sovereign, independent Ukraine living next door to them.
Did you happen to see the documentary Watch Winter on Fire, Ukraine's Fight for Freedom?
Oh, a while ago. Was it?
The 2015. I just mention it because I think they did a good job of bringing context to this. They looked at the peaceful student demonstrations that became a full-fledged movement for basic rights. I think they do a really good job of providing context to find out in some ways how we got to this point and really focusing on young Ukrainians and the future that they want for themselves.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I think it's so important to talk about this. I think what happened in, you know, in Maidan, the revolution of dignity in 2012, 2013, they are still being punished for that. And it was a genuine, democratic, extraordinary movement of people. Ukrainians always like to joke that they're very good at evicting leaders once they go corrupt or if they're fed up with them. But it's kind of true, do you know? It's kind of extraordinary and amazing now to see in recent weeks. You know, there was this stupid law that Zelensky did about trying to change the abilities of some of the anti-corruption agencies, and the streets were full of people protesting in Kiev, and those people were so young. They were kids at the time of Maidan, and yet that tradition, that culture of protest, of shaping your own society, you know, building a society that the kind that you want to see, and very much people have a really good understanding, I find, in Ukraine of their role in society and in the state. And I always remember this one thing my friend said to me, that because of this, like, a lot of civic society, helping the army, helping refugees. And I had a friend, we were talking in Kharkiv a few years ago, and she was, I write about her a lot in my book. She's a great hero of mine, Ivana. And she had worked in theatre and cultural stuff. And I remember saying to her, man, do you never get annoyed? Do you know that your whole life has become about just trying to raise money and trying to help, you know, the fire service and the army, just trying to keep your country afloat? And I said, do you never feel, God, you know, where's the state? And she said, quick as a flash, she turned to me and she said, well, we are the state. And it just really struck me as something that, like, you know, in my society, we could do with a wee bit of that, you know?
We're speaking with Jen Stout, an award-winning journalist and author of Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war. What have you heard from Ukrainians about Trump meeting with Putin in Alaska, bringing out the red carpet, shaking hands, smiling?
Extreme cynicism. And, you know, really extreme cynicism. I think they understand that this isn't leading to any peace negotiations. And probably that's because they're also more attuned to the kind of Kremlin speak, if we can call it that. So when Lavrov and co talk about the root causes, they say, well, we would love to meet, you know, of course we'll meet Zelensky, but first we have to tackle the root causes of this war. What they mean by that is an independent Ukraine. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's, and they say, oh, we need a fair balance of security. That is Kremlin talk for removing NATO forces from the Baltics, Poland, Romania, completely unacceptable stuff. So I think anyone who understands that, and Ukrainians understands what Russia's about very, very well, they know that this isn't the basis for a lasting peace or even a ceasefire. I think they're looking far more to Europe now, you know, and I think they're right to do so. And Europe needs to really get its act together, right? And we had this meeting at the White House the other day with some EU leaders, though I think not enough from Eastern Europe, frankly, with some proposals put forward. But it's not enough, and it's not fast enough, really.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for Jen Stout, what did you think of the media coverage of Trump meeting with Putin and then Zelensky? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So what are your thoughts overall? Do you see any progress in any of these meetings? Is this political theater?
I personally don't. Maybe I'm being a bit cynical. I think it's spectacle. It's a really kind of revolting spectacle to see a war criminal welcomed to America with a red carpet. I mean, goodness me, what does that say about the country, about where we are kind of internationally, international order? Also, I mean, how, you know, there's been talk of a possible Putin meeting in certain European countries. If they've signed the statute for the International Criminal Court, they have to arrest him, you know. And we'll see if, you know, maybe Geneva is going to weasel out of that. But of course, America does not back the International Criminal Court, and that's why he was able to go to Alaska. But what a revolting spectacle, really. It's horrific after all these years of war and everything that we know he has done. And the sort of the rhetoric at these talks, I do think it gets very overblown, the way that the coverage kind of, I think we're being far too hopeful, and we're kind of buying into what my really big worry is, that this is all a bit of a trap. You know, the Ukrainians get presented with things that they can't possibly accept, like giving up the whole of Donbass region. They can't accept that for lots of different reasons. But that's given as this, like, completely absurd demand by the Russians. The Ukrainians say, well, we can't accept this. And then Trump can say, well, look, they're the ones being obstructive, and I'm not going to give them any more aid, you know. But at least then we'd know where we are, wouldn't we, with where America stands, and really hopefully that would put the pressure onto Europe properly and fully, so they understand that it's really down to them.
Do you have any insights into the relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin?
Look, I don't personally believe the speculation that he's somehow an asset or that they have some kind of compromise on him. But he's clearly very enamored. Trump is very enamored with Putin, and Putin can just twist him around his little finger. I mean, Putin's very good at this stuff. When he came out with that, what did he say about the sort of confirming what Trump had suggested, that if Trump had been in power, but you know, 4 years ago, then this war would never have happened, which is such a ridiculous claim. I don't understand what that could even mean. But Putin sort of echoed that, and he's, you know, I think a lot of world leaders are engaging in the whole sort of Trump tickling at the moment, where they kiss up to him and say what they think he'll want to hear, even like Mark Rutte, NATO General Secretary, calling him daddy, which I think all of us are still feeling a bit sick after that. So yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a sort of asset relationship. I don't think he's controlling him, but he certainly does seem to buy, Trump seems to buy into Putin's narrative about this war to a great extent.
We have a listener who wrote in who wants to know where the drones and missiles are coming from on the Russian side.
Oh, all over. So missiles can come from, they can come from planes or from bases, sort of usually nearer to the border with Ukraine, but from all over different parts of Russia, from Crimea, which is occupied, of course, from occupied Ukraine, Donbass. The drones have increasingly very long ranges, so they can go really, really far, and they're also now being equipped with much bigger warheads, and that's why you're seeing these like horrific explosions and massive damage and fires to often blocks of flats and hospitals and so on in Kiev and Kharkiv in particular. But I mean, we saw, was it last night, there was with that huge number of drones and missiles, and they were mostly targeting Western Ukraine, which is quite unusual and clearly a bit of a deliberate signal they're trying to send, not least hitting that American electronics manufacturer.
And then also Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, an embarrassment for Russia, really.
With the drones. The Washington Post had a piece in May called Russia's Deadly Drone Industry Upgraded with Iran's Help.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and now the Russians have been able to, as I understand, reproduce those drones, so that they're not getting them directly from Iran. But yeah, this is a big question about sanctions as well, because it's not just their nasty little friends, you know, Iran and North Korea, that are helping the Russians. There are Western components being found in drones that are brought down all the time because the sanctions don't work, and that's really worrying.
What are your thoughts about the debate that happens among scholars in the United States about, and we just got an email actually from Rob who says, can you please comment on those who say that the main issue is do not bait Russia, a country with an imperial history, a horrible history of attacking Ukraine. Yes, Russia is bad, just like the United States, but this is a proxy war. I mean, you're hearing a lot from scholars in the United States about how NATO is the issue. And then you hear others say it's the land, that Russia wants the land. What are your thoughts about that debate that happens in the US?
Yeah, look, it happens here too, particularly on the left. And I find it extremely infuriating. There's a lot, I mean, you know, the stuff that Chomsky was saying about Ukraine, it was so misinformed. And you just think, my God, could you read something? Or have you just like plucked this out of thin air or from some Russian website? I mean, I struggle with this a lot, and I try to explain to people, you know, that it's very, very clear from Putin's speeches and things that were said at the time that his reason for attacking Ukraine repeatedly is not because of some perceived threat from NATO. It's just not the case. It's because he doesn't think it should exist. And because they hated to see Ukraine do so well. You know, Ukraine was starting to flourish. It was slowly crawling out of the post-Soviet stuff and society was really advancing. And that's not the case in Russia. And I think they were also punishing them for that. Listen to the stuff that Putin says about Moldova, or Medvedev has said about Moldova, another country that they want to have back in their influence, their sphere, or just their control, actually, frankly. Moldova is still partially occupied by Russian troops in Transnistria. And they said things like, gosh, you know, perhaps we'll have to go and protect the Russian speakers there. They say the same thing about Latvia. This is a clear threat, a clear threat. So, and also I think the argument about, oh, it's all NATO's fault for expanding. If countries wanted to join NATO, it was their democratic decision to do so. And they wanted to join NATO because they were scared of Russia, quite rightly. Yeah.
Well, and he's willing to sacrifice so many of his own people. I mean, the numbers of soldiers that have been lost on the Russian side is, all the numbers are staggering, but 1 million Russian troops have been killed or wounded.
Yeah, so this is the horrible, grim stuff that faces Ukraine, because if you refuse to fight in the dirty way that your opponent is fighting, you know, the Ukrainian army doesn't throw people into meat waves, meat assaults, a horrible phrase, and the Russian army does that all the time as a matter of course. It's very hard to it's very hard to win against that, because I mean, if you have wave after wave after wave of Russian soldiers swamping a position, you can try and, you know, you can kill a lot of them as they come towards you, but eventually they probably will swamp that position, like walking over the bodies of their fallen comrades. We also know, I mean, you hear all these reports of what happens behind the lines, behind the Russian lines, and the way that the troops are treated, I mean, abysmally. Some evidence of that kind of Stalinist stuff of like, no turning back, you'll get shot if you turn back. They're torturing their own troops. I mean, you're up against something that I think could be described as evil and as fascist. And how do you fight that when they have more men and they're willing to do appalling, disgusting things to them?
Devastating. I mentioned in the intro that in March 2023, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest for Putin for deporting and transferring children from occupied areas of Ukraine to Russia. Ukraine says that Russia has taken 20,000 children. Does that sound right to you?
I think it could be much more.
Wow.
I think that's the conservative estimate. Yeah. Other estimates go up to 100,000. We really don't know. A lot, if you remember last year, a lot of the data was being gathered in a sort of American backed project. And then with the cuts to USAID, that was one of the projects that the funding was cut to it, which is really, really worrying, really dangerous, because these children have to be returned. I mean, I didn't see Putin having to discuss that in Alaska, did you? Like, he didn't even have to discuss these things that he's done. He just had a nice jolly time with Trump, didn't discuss withdrawing his troops, didn't discuss reparations, any of the things that would be on the table in a real negotiation, and particularly, as you say, the return of these tens of thousands of children.
Devastating. One more question, Jen. Are you able to go to Russia to report? I've been thinking about, in 2022, so many journalists fled, and then in 2022, Russia passed a law banning journalists from calling what is happening in Ukraine a war or an invasion. Journalists can face up to 15 years in prison.
Well, they banned everyone from doing that. Yeah. Look, in theory, I could apply to go to Russia as a journalist. I will not do that because I don't think it would be very safe, frankly. I do think that it's good that there are Western reporters there covering what's happening in that society. It is good, but I'm very glad I'm not one of them. I'd rather be in Donbass under the shelling than spend another minute in Moscow, frankly.
Well, Jen, thank you so much for your work. It's so important. Jen Stout is an award-winning journalist, radio producer, photojournalist, and author of Night Train to Odessa, covering the human cost of Russia's war. Thank you so much, Jen.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we'll learn more about EJ Antoni. Trump has tapped him to lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics. He is a Heritage Foundation economist and contributor to Project 2025. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.